Each in it, so thank you. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, January 25th, 2024. And present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon will be coming in a little later, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Edgman, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, and Representative Colomb, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And let's see here, before we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. This afternoon, we have two bills before us. The first is an introduction for the committee substitute for House Bill 89, and that is the Daycare Assistance and Child Care Grant Program. Then we're going to take invited and public testimony. We'll set an amendment deadline for the bill and then set that aside. And then the second bill is an introduction of the committee substitute for House Bill 50. And that is a bill that we're probably well familiar with, and that is the carbon storage bill. We'll hear from the Department of Natural Resources about the changes that were made to the bill and the committee substitutes. And then we will set that bill aside as well. So first up, House Bill 89, it's Daycare Assistance and Child Care Grant Program Bill. Co-Chair Johnson, if I could entertain a motion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move that House Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 89, Worthcraft 33-LS0518-S, dated 1/3/24 is our working document.
Thank you, and I will go ahead and object for the purposes of an explanation and ask Representative Colomb, as well as your staff, if you'd like to come up to the Diaz there and if you can explain the changes. They also have in the audience Leah Van Kirk, a policy advisor for the Department of Health, will be available for questions. So with that, if you would kindly put yourselves on the record, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My name is Julie Colomb. This is my staff, Aaliyah Preston. I want to thank you and the Finance Committee for an opportunity to present again HB 89. We have updated our presentation to hopefully answer questions that came up last year to give a better understanding of the bill. The governor last year said he has a vision of making Alaska more affordable for families, and I share that vision. Part of accomplishing this vision is affordable, quality child care that is accessible to families. Child care is a workforce issue. Many Alaskans would go back to work, take on more work, and become more reliable workers if we had high-quality, affordable care. We are all aware of our workforce shortages and the out-migration of young working families from our great state. The jobs are here, but for many reasons, including housing, education, training, and certainly the availability of child care, we face a workforce shortage. It's estimated that the lack of reliable child care costs employers in the state of Alaska $152 million in employee absences and turnover. This is an issue we can help solve. HB 89 is a call to the private sector to look at child care as an employee benefit and to the public sector to update the way we support families and regulate the industry. As a member of the child care of the governor's child care task force, I've heard of the problems that surround the child care sector. I've talked with private businesses that are open and willing to help their employees with child care but don't know where to start. I've met with child care providers that share with me how regulations weigh them down in paperwork and keep their businesses from thriving. The recommendations that came from that task force address these concerns. HB 89 moves in the same direction as the task force recommendations. I had a conservative colleague ask me the other day, why is it the government's responsibility to provide child care? It's a question that I, as a conservative, have been wrestling with, especially in an economy that is desperate for workers and a society where children are struggling to be ready for kindergarten. From my perspective, it's not the government's responsibility to provide child care, but government can create an environment that encourages businesses to offer child care benefits, to make it easier for those who want to start a childcare business and encourage local communities to create innovative choices for different kinds of care. It could also assist parents in accessing childcare to enable them to grow their household income. My bill does not propose to spend a lot of short-term money on the situation, but to provide a long-term incentive for our communities to solve the problem. So to wrap up, I want to point out that women are over 60% of Alaska's workforce, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We are in the top 10 states for the percentage of working women. And as long as Alaska's energy, housing, and grocery prices keep growing, parents, single and married, will have to work to keep up. It's time for us to work with the governor and act on this pressing issue. I thank you for your time and your consideration. So now I'll turn it over to my staff, Leah Preston, for the sexual analysis and short presentation.
Hello. For the record, my name is Leah Preston, and I am a staffer for Representative Cologne. I will be presenting the bill HB 89. But first, I'm going to do the sectional analysis. Sections 1 through 21 are concerning the tax credits. If you would like, I would read all of them, but they are pretty much the same things repetitively, so if it's okay with the chair, I'll just skip through those and just give you a brief of what they are. Section 1 talks about the offsetting cost eligible for the insurance tax credits, the income tax education credits, the oil and gas producer education tax credits, the property tax education tax credits, the mining tax education credits, the fishery business for tax credits, floating fishery business tax credits. It also, section 2 and forward, is to increase the maximum individual tax credit limit from $1 million to $3 million. Section 3 adds a new section to adjust the maximum individual tax credit limit every 5 years for inflation. And then picking up on section 22 is conforming language to change daycare to childcare. Is conforming language to change daycare to childcare in section 23. Section 24 contains conforming language to childcare and also states that the monthly household income limit for an eligible family to receive assistance is 105% of the median household income in Alaska, adjusted for family size. Section 25 is regarding administrative costs of program contractors with conforming language to childcare. Section 26, with conforming language from daycare to childcare. Section 27, with conforming language from daycare to childcare. Section 28, this section provides that the parent or guardian contribution for childcare assistance shall not be greater than 7% of the family monthly income. This was a recommendation of the governor's task force on childcare. It's amended from 9%. With conforming section 29 with conforming language from daycare to childcare. Section 30 adds new subsection to require the department to use a market rate study for each region served by the program to determine the actual amounts of assistance available for assistance. Section 31 with conforming language from daycare to childcare. Section 32 with conforming language from daycare to childcare. Section 33 adds new subsection to allow the department to award grants to child care facilities that are the highest performing and highest quality. Section 34 to update the definition of child care facility to include an established recognized by the federal government. Section 35 to add conforming language to the definition of child care. Section 36 repealer section. Section 37 adds uncodifying law directing the department to submit the child care assistant program as amended by this bill to the federal government for approval. Section 38 adds uncodified law providing a conditional effective date of January 1st, 2025 if the program is approved by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Section 39 through 42 changes the effective date, and the department can speak to this, but it will probably need to be amended.
And before you start, Co-Chair Foster, is it okay if we hold questions till the end?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, hello. For the record again, my name is Aaliyah Preston, and I am a staffer for Representative Cologne. I will be presenting the bill HB 89. HB 89 addresses a specific problem of lack of affordable quality child care. And because of this, it worsens the labor shortages because people cannot go back to work. It endangers children. It undermines families' economic security and therefore decreases the workforce participation. However, HB 89 provides a solution to strengthen the child care sector to improve access for families and help parents return to the workforce. One might ask, why is Alaska in a child care crisis? We found after visiting many child care providers that, like many industries, there were labor shortages, a declining number of child care providers, and the workers were not compelled to stay because of low wages. However, HB 89 provides multiple approaches to solve the problem. It expands the number of families who can use child care assistance. It incentivizes tax breaks for employees to donate to child care facilities. It increases the maximum tax credit. And finally, it aligns the assistant level to reflect the actual cost of care. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Alaska is losing $152 million due to employee turnover and absences. So this proves that it's not just affecting families of small children, but it's affecting the workforce as a whole. When doing our research for this bill, we discovered that assistance needs to be tied to the actual cost of care. Currently, the state rate is based on a market rate study, and the Alaska Department of Health is contracting with McKinley Group to complete the study by July 31st, 2024. However, this still must be approved by the federal government.
So, if I may add to that. So I just wanted a little bit of explanation. We've been kind of in the weeds, so I wanted to just kind of give some background. So right now, the market study is based on what the child care providers are charging now, but it's not enough to sustain their business. So if a child care provider actually charged parents what it's actually costing them, it would price parents out of the market. So this is where it's difficult for businesses to stay afloat because they're not getting enough income to cover their expenses. So last year, part of the bill was to get an actual cost of care. The department took that on right away. We took it out of the bill. And so that's where the contracting with the McKinley Group, that's in process right now. The date has been moved back to July 31. You may have heard the governor speak about kind of holding back what he's going to do on a big scale with child care because of a study. That's what he's talking about. So we're trying to find what the actual cost of care in Alaska actually is. And the department can speak to this later more, but my understanding is that the federal government has to approve the methodology for that in order for it to move forward. So right now, the statute is a market study or a cost of care. So,
great. Thank you. I'd just like to also note for the record that we've been joined by Representative Hennen. Please proceed.
How does HB 89 help solve our child care problem in Alaska? Basically by changing who is eligible for assistance. Right now, families that make up to 85% of the state median income, which is $6,144 in Alaska, for one earner. HB 89 will raise that to 105%, which is the state median income of $73,920 in Alaska for one earner. Now, the way it currently is, most middle-class families cannot afford childcare. But with HB 89, it will enable the department to scale the subsidy level based on need. Now, the lack of affordable care equals severe labor shortages in every industry. HB 89 will help solve that by expanding the number of families who can afford care, which equals more Alaskans going back to work. Right now, there is a 9% cap. HB 89 lowers that to a 7% cap of the family income.
And if I may, to give some context with this, so the way it works now, families have a copay that they have to pay. The assistant doesn't cover everything with their child care bill. So some of the problems is not only is the copay starts to increase as you have multiple children, right? So there's a delta there. But they may be able to cover the copay. But they also have to cover the difference between what the child care assistance gives them and their child care providers. So a lot of times when we were meeting with parents and child care providers, they have to pay the difference of the childcare price, and they also have to pay the copay. So that's the context of the 9% and the 7% cap. So right now they don't pay anything above 9% of their family income, and the bill proposes a 7% cap.
Great, thank you. I would also like to recognize that we're joined by Representative Ortiz, and then from the start, we've also had Representative Wright with us, and then Representative Gray has also joined us. So thanks for being here. Just for the folks who have come in, we're holding questions till the end of the presentation. So with that, please proceed.
Okay, the child tax credits. We mentioned that was part of the solution to our child care crisis, and just a brief explanation of how they work. These people, the state of income tax, the mining license tax, the fishery business, fisheries, oil and gas production, and oil and gas property and insurance will be able to write off their contributions to the child care sector. We don't know exactly how that will work, but we are copying basically what was from HB 223.
So I'll take this on. So I have HB 223 here because it's a good background of what we're trying to do. So the educational tax credits were from the 80s actually, but in 2018 they updated it. 2019 they updated. You can see that they were changing the percentages, and the cap is on the far right hand side, right? So it started at 5 million. In 2021, it went to $1 million. So for an educational tax credit, you can write off up to $1 million. The bill increases that cap to $3 million. So there's it would operate just like the educational tax credits. The list that Ms. Preston listed out, those are the taxes that they didn't offset. So it's mainly, you know, mining, fishing, oil, and the corporate tax. So the 223 was actually from a presentation to take the sunset date off of the educational tax credits. But I thought it would give some context for people who aren't familiar with the credit. It's going to operate just like the educational tax credits, if that helps. One of the questions last year from Representative Josephson was in regards to the local taxes. And I think we have somebody from the tax division here, but it's my understanding that the credit would only come out of the state portion. It would not affect the local contribution. I think that's it.
And with that, that's the presentation of our bill. Thank you for hearing it.
Great. Thank you very much. So we'll go to questions for the sponsor. And then we'll continue with the motion, which was the adoption of the CS. So again, it's not moving the bill out. It's just adopting this new version of the bill, the CS committee substitute. And then we'll move to public testimony. So with that, questions, Representative Hannon and then Galvin. Step.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, Representative Colon, I'm really interested in the tax credit portion, and I'm curious, could a company that's got enough, could they simply pay for their workers' childcare and take that off of it so they could add it as a benefit to their employees and get a tax credit for it, which is...
So through the chair to Representative Hannon, yeah. But in the bill, it lists lots of different types of contributions. It can include building their own childcare center. It can include... giving money to help cover child care costs. It can be improving a child care center. There's a lot of different aspects in the bill listed, yes.
Great, thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you for this work. Thank you for sitting in on the task force. As you know, I'm just so grateful. I do have a couple of questions. One is related to the tax credits. If you could just help me track through this. So I have for mining, fishing, and oil, those who are already paying some sort of a tax, a corporate tax, they then would get a credit. So presumably families who are associated with those particular industries would likely have a bit of an edge or an opportunity, if you will, which would be helpful for our workforce in those sectors especially. I appreciate that. I'm curious to know if there's been any thought about other industries or other ways we might extend that so that for healthcare and other kind of workers where we'd love to have opportunities. Is there something there as well?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, are you asking to expand the credits to other areas? That's not a question. I don't think I could answer that.
Okay.
Follow up.
Thank you. And it sounds like by moving the ceiling of families who are eligible for the assistance through the federal guidelines and such, once that's done, we will increase the number of families who will then have the opportunity for assistance. And so we'll have a greater number of those in need, if you will, who are ready to enter the market of childcare. I'm wondering about, and perhaps this is coming because once we see the price of childcare covered to a higher degree, we'll see more. But my question is, what are we doing, or is there anything in here that might bring back some of the, I think we lost a couple of hundred in Anchorage alone, childcare centers. Is there anything to expand the number of seats, if you will, for those who need childcare?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin. So my plan was that if we start incentivizing the private sector and infusing some money into the childcare sector, that will start to happen. They have so a lot on the task force was about low wages, and there's space in the childcare centers. They literally have rooms empty because they can't find the workers. Mm-hmm. My approach was to get the private sector motivated to get involved and to start injecting the industry with more stable money so they can fill the rooms. We didn't see too many that where childcare centers were just busting at the seams. It was usually empty rooms. So I'd like to fill the rooms first.
Thank you. Through the chair, if I may, one final question in thinking about the issue of labor and lack of childcare providers. I know that the state has come up with the QRAS, so some standards around what is best practices of childcare to make sure we're getting at quality childcare. And I know that our university system has a small program where we are growing a pipeline of care providers, so to speak, and I just didn't know if that had been part of the work of the task force too, ways we might encourage people to choose this profession. And it sounds like wages is pretty much the number one, but is there anything else that we can do?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, so the university actually just expanded that program in the Department of Health. If you want more details, they can come and tell you. But we did have a presentation from UAA, and it's a pretty exciting program, and there's a lot of scholarships being offered for people to get in there, get trained, get their certificates, and be positioned where they can earn more wages because they're well-trained. And so I think the university is going to be key to get the pipeline going again. That's something that kind of fell apart through COVID. So they're ramping that up again, and I'm hoping that will help get the training piece. Because, I mean, in any sector, you're paid higher because you're well-trained. And so if we're a lot of child care providers that we talked to, they hire people with absolutely no training and start from the ground floor. And most of them pay for their training, pay for their time to be trained, which is another hit to the bottom line for the child care providers. So I'm pretty excited about the program at UAA. It's good.
Follow up.
Thank you. One follow up on the quality piece. I think I saw, maybe it wasn't in the fiscal note, but perhaps one of your others, the sponsor statement. think, something that is around grants for high-quality child care centers, those who are performing highest. And I just wondered if there was any more explanation on that.
So through the chair to Representative Galvin, so it might be helpful to have the Department of Health talk about that, but it just gives them the room to offer a financial incentive to climb the quality ladder, right? So part of that is my understanding is through THRED, which is a nonprofit and supports the child care industry.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative. Also, just a reminder, we do have available for questions Ms. Leah Van Kirk with the Department of Health. So with that, Representative Sapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Colomb. First, I just wanted to put on the record that I've heard a lot about child care issues, and I think I can say, and probably many of the members, if not everyone at this Finance Committee table, I don't think there is a single person in this building who has worked harder on trying to figure out this issue than you have, Representative Cologne. So I think the task force has been a great thing. I have some curiosities. I'm not super well-versed, so my apologies if these questions are answered with this big mound of supporting documents, which is evident by how thick the packet was. So my first question is, I come from an insurance background. I'm wondering if the task force had any recommendations outside of our preview, say maybe a resolution for us to our partners in the federal government pertaining to dependent care accounts for savings. So folks who don't know, there's a program called a dependent care account. It's on an FSA or an HSA. It allows individuals and families to contribute $5,000 for the purpose of child care, and that money is pre-tax dollars. That cap has been that level of an amount of money for over a decade. So if you could speak to that, and then I have a follow-up, Chair Foster.
So through the chair to Representative Staff, I don't remember that. I may have the Department of Health come and speak about that, but through the task force, I don't think we ever addressed that. I was aware of that, but the idea of doing a resolution or putting that pushing that part of it is a great idea. But it would be great if you don't mind having the Department of Health come and speak, just in case I missed something.
Ms. Van Kirk, if you can put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health.
Thanks. And
Through the chair to Representative Foster. Sorry, this is a long-winded question, Co-Chair Foster. Thoughts on dependent care accounts, I guess, is the question, on the limits.
Thank you. Through the chair to Rep. Staff, we have not addressed that in the governor's task force meetings yet. There has been a focus on exploring employer-based benefits, and there's actually 33 recommendations in the governor's task force on child care initial report that was submitted on December 31st. So thank you for asking that question, and I think the task force is welcome to recommendations and hearing interest specifically related to that.
Yeah, and a quick follow-up, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Colomb. So my other thought on this is, is there anything that you guys considered maybe on the regulatory side that we would have to address in a bill like yours? Are there regulatory issues? Are there statutory issues that are serving as impediments to licensing new child care facilities that would help be more competitive? So that was my other question. Thank you.
So through the chair to Representative Stapp. Yes, we dealt with a lot of regulatory, and there's a lot of regulatory recommendations. Most of those recommendations can come through the department. It doesn't need a statutory change. A lot of what we found was just the access to licensing through the to get licensed to be a child care provider. So currently, There's no electronic forms on the website. It's very hard to navigate. Someone will have to print out the form, fill it out, and mail it in. So these were easy things that are causing a lot of problems that can be fixed. So there was a lot of recommendations around licensing, the background checks, the website. I don't know if Ms. Van Kirk wants to add on to that.
Ms. Van Kirk?
Thank you. Through the chair to representative staff, during the first 6 months of our meetings, we focused on three different areas. So recommendations related to workforce, employer-based programs, background checks, and licensing. And so many of those components really opened up regulatory pieces that we identified we could address through regulation. So that may include the methodology that we use when we adopt a state rate. That could include child care administrative requirements. We talked about the university and training available to support the professional growth of the field. And so those are all areas that have come up during these first 6 months that we have been able to look at regulation and really assess what types of regulatory changes we could recommend in order to reduce some of the barriers that the child care workforce is seeing now.
Yeah, thank you. Follow up, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Colom. And on that note, I just want to thank you and the department, especially Rep. Colom. I had a big issue with my largest child care facility in my own district in Fairbanks, and you guys did an amazing job expediting that. And on behalf of my district, thank you very much.
Great. I've got questions from Representative Josephson and then Representative Ortiz. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Mr. Rep. Colom, the funding sources then under the bill would continue the Child Care Development Fund and add to it a tax credit, and those would be the two principal sources. Is that right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, that's my understanding, unless the Department of Health wants to correct me.
Follow up.
And it looks like the foregone revenue, which I don't think is substantial. I don't mean to suggest it is, but that it's in the range of, in the out years, $4.7 million. Does that sound right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson. So it's hard to predict who's going to take advantage of this, right? So I do have a list, like for the educational tax credits, within, looks like about 10 years, the credits claimed were $65 million and the contributions were $97 million to education. So that was a slow build, though. That took year after year after year. And so we can't really predict who's going to take advantage of that. Maybe it's going to be this big. Maybe it won't. But I did a lot of research around the educational tax credits just to get my head wrapped around the possibilities of businesses investing. They're investing in education now. It went down when they started adjusting the percentages and the caps. But I'm hoping, although it will probably take a while to get going, I'm hoping there's going to be a lot of participation. You could look at it as a state foregoing revenue. In my opinion, it's an investment in the state.
Follow-up?
I guess my last follow-up, and I don't mean to suggest I don't like the bill, but I'm reminded from the fiscal note that at the height of COVID, we received $22 million 1 year. And I'm just wondering why this amount of money is going to be adequate to move, to put a shift in the problem and sort of free up sufficient resources for parents and for the workforce to get paid adequately, that sort of thing.
So through the chair to Representative Josephson, my bill is not fixing everything. Okay, this is a start and it's a beginning. I would say that it would be difficult to compare the COVID situation to going forward. That $22 million was trying to save a lot of child care centers that were closing very quickly. And so I think going forward, although we're struggling, I don't think we're going to get hit that hard that fast. So my intention is that there is a slow investment that builds over time. It's not going to be a big amount of money. And as we saw, really, with all that money, we still lost a lot of child care centers. So it's not just an infusion of money. The working with the pipeline for workers, trying to get people more access, getting the private sector involved, in my opinion, is going to work a lot better than just throwing a lot of money at it right away, because it just didn't. It helped some child care providers stay open, but we still lost a lot of providers. So.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, the task force, did you folks look at other states and programs that are currently going on in other states and how they're trying to address the child care problem around the country?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz. For the record, this is Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. Yes, we have met with other states. We have also met with the Office of Child Care on a national level to learn what is happening nationally that is making a difference in other states. So we absolutely have engaged local, state, and national partners to really help inform our steps forward.
Okay. And I have a follow-up to that. The reason why I asked that specific question is I was able to go to a national legislators conference a couple of years ago, and I believe it was Kentucky had a model plan that they were launching just pretty much at that time in relationship to their child care issues that were pretty extensive in that state. Theirs was a different model based on the state providing resources to businesses to subsidize those businesses so that they could use those resources to further entice workers to work in their business by these cash subsidies that they were getting from the state. Yours is based on a tax credit model, or not yours, but Representative Colon's. My question is, on the tax credit model, is there a measurement as to how much, by going the tax credit route, how much that's going to reach into the issue? How much will that, quote, cover the issue in relationship to our child care needs in the state of Alaska? You know, for example, the tax credit that would go to fisheries resource landing tax. I'm thinking fishermen pay a landing tax, but I don't know if there's a direct connection there between how that would work for them, because they don't certainly provide, as fishermen, child care opportunities. That would be a different thing. I'm just wondering how big of an impact would this be on the overall problem. Is there an estimate as to that?
So through the chair to Representative Ortiz, I don't think we know what the impact is. I think the state net income tax would be helpful. I don't know any other way to get a sustainable model than get the private sector into this problem. Katie Capozzi from the chamber was on the task force as well. It's one of their priorities. We've got to get private businesses to understand that this is a benefit to workers. And so I can't tell you exactly how much this is going to impact it, but I know there's a lot of interest in businesses helping their employees get child care. So I'm hoping not only, so even if I can't give you a percentage, I'm trying to shift the mindset of the private sector to open up. And when people start doing it, businesses talk and they start sharing ideas. My bill, or HB 89, also establishes a program to partner with private sector entities. So the program will have somebody to help private sectors understand how to set up a child care center, or how can they give benefits to help pay for child care for their workers. And so there's going to be a good partnership there, and it's a beginning. It's not everything. But, you know, so I can't, for me, it's more of shifting the mindset and sending an invitation to the private sector to help the state solve the problem.
Follow up.
And when I ask the question, please, I would like to join Representative Stapp in thanking you for bringing forward this this particular bill. We do need some attempts at dealing with the problem, and this is certainly that, and I commend you on that. So my questions are in no way discrediting your efforts, let's put it that way. And then a follow-up question I have is on this fiscal note, the one that says HB 89 across the top bill version, and it's at the very first top of my page anyway, it reflects annual 194 million or 194,000. What is that number there year after year?
So through the chair, if you may, if it's okay, Chair, we maybe have the Department of Health explain what's going on with the fiscal note.
Ms. Van Kirk.
Thank you. For the record, Leah Van Kirk from the Department of Health, Healthcare Policy Advisor. Currently, there is going to be an updated fiscal note, which will assess the current committee substitute. And so that will be available publicly after the hearing.
And that previous question is the 194,000.
Yep. Well, through the chair to Representative Ortiz, it's not million. It's
yeah.
Thousand.
Okay.
Not proposing 194 million.
Okay.
Yes.
So then, follow up. So this must be the cost to provide staff within the state to implement the bill or implement the program, et cetera. Is that what this is about?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, yes.
Okay. So that makes sense.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, if I could just add, so last year, this was the only fiscal note we could get, was the additional staff to deal with what was being proposed. They were having a really difficult time figuring out how the subsidy was going to impact. And so they worked really hard, and there's a fiscal note coming. It's not here because we haven't adopted the CS yet. So we'll get that at another meeting.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got Representative Hannon and then Representative Stapp. Representative Hannon and then Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, my question is actually for Ms. Van Kirk. From as the Child Care Task Force looked at licensing being a hurdle for new business coming on, I'm wondering if you. What your vacancy rate in the child care licensing office is, or if you've had high turnover, because besides describing sort of an antiquated process that's difficult to deal with, we know that it takes skilled staff to help someone through any of these licensure process. And whether the child care licensing, whether you have a specific vacancy rate or noticed turnover there, and although it wouldn't be directly a fiscal cost of the bill to make this happen, we need to make sure that the people on the state side are there to help process that. So if you can speak to it.
Yeah. Through the chair to Representative Hannon, Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor. I can't speak to the specific vacancy rate of the Child Care Program Office. I can say that the leadership and managers at the Child Care Program Office have maintained consistency for many years. I know that we continue to struggle with workforce issues and that administering what is recommended in this bill would take additional staffing.
Thank you.
If I could add, Chair, mm-hmm. through the chair to Representative Hannon, Anchorage has its own licensing office. They have no vacancies. But they have had a pretty sharp turnover the last 3 years, so we have some inexperience working there. The state office had been at the task force meetings. There was no talk of any substantial vacancies there. I think it was two the last time they spoke to it.
Great, thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I, too, want to extend my appreciation to all the work you've done, Representative Clone, you and your staff, Ms. Van Kirk. I know you've been involved in this for the time as well with the task force, but just maybe a couple framing questions so I can help me sort of come up to speed on the legislation. I guess the first question would be, you've got the task force that, and Mr. Coacher, I had to step out for just a second, so I might have missed this, but you've got the task force on one track, if you will, that hasn't finished its work. Then you have this legislation sort of separately, but maybe also jointly, definition of daycare to childcare, things like that. That sort of has some interplay with the task force. Is that a correct way to kind of describe it?
So through the chair to Representative Edgman, the things proposed here are specific recommendations in the first report. So the tax credits, the reaching out, helping, getting a coordinator, having more access, raising the income level so people can access it. Those are in the first report. They're not all the recommendations, but this is in line with our task force recommendations. There'll be a second report after, which is what you were talking to as well. But it is in line with the task force for sure. Specific recommendations. I didn't know if you wanted to add anything.
Through the chair to Representative Edgman, Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. There have been many specific and broad areas that the task force has examined over the last 6 months. There's been 15 meetings with presenters at almost every meeting, and there are clearly, Representative Kloem's bill identifies some of the recommendations that are included in the initial draft that we submitted on December 31st for that first set of recommendations.
Follow-up?
So, a number of us have attended both events in Alaska and outside Alaska on child care and what other states are doing and how. You know, in some states, it's pretty well established. They've got the system in place. They've got fiscal mapping. They've got the modeling that's taking place. They've got established relationships with federal agencies for grants. They've got sort of state funding streams in place, things like that. Is that, and again, I'm tying this into the bill that we have before us, but is that the sort of eventual direction that the task force is going to come to the legislature with in terms of sort of building on what we have in place in Alaska? And I guess I'll wrap all this up by saying that I'll go back to Representative Kloem's comments early on. I think I heard that, you know, right now it's really hard just to make a child care center work without having some kind of help, right? And I'd like to hear your thoughts on kind of where things are going with the task force, a shortened version, if you would please. I'm sort of building all this into the question I want to finish up with. So.
Through the chair to Representative Edgman, Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. I believe that when the task force makes their final recommendations, I think there are many multifaceted approaches to how we approach child care in Alaska. I think that's going to be a combination of looking at federal funding resources, state funding resources. I think it will include regulatory changes. And I think it has to include partnership with private businesses and organizations. I can say one encouraging thing about this work is that many Alaskans are interested because it's impacting them, even if they don't have children. We have employers reaching out to the task force, to the Child Care Program Office, to ask about what they can do to support the workforce in Alaska. So I anticipate we'll have a broad approach with, you know, additional recommendations in how we can tackle some of the issues and challenges that we're faced with.
Mr. Co-Chair, you know, broadband is kind of coming to mind too, because it's just not economically feasible without help from state government, federal government sources, primarily, I guess, Alaska, to build it out, to put it into place. The market just wouldn't bear that cost. But is that sort of the sense, maybe directing this more towards the bill sponsor going forward, that we're going to put a model together that, like Ms. Van Kirk was saying, really, you know, involves the private sector, of course, but also involves some type of help to get it over the top, make this, you know, these child care centers actually work economically? Is that sort of the general direction we're going in?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Edgman. Yeah, I think for me, I saw a very big opportunity to get the private sector involved. Obviously, with the final report, we'll have to see what other fund sources are going to come into play. The governor has said that he's kind of holding off on doing anything major or substantial on the state level before that final report. So I don't think this is done. I think there's still more research to be done on what those sources will look like. I have looked at a lot of other states and how they're solving their child care problems. The difficulty with that is Alaska is really unique, and some of those solutions I did not see really working in Alaska. So I think we took good ideas from other states. It wasn't, I never found, maybe there's others that disagree, but I never found a state that I could just take this and plop it into Alaska. We just, the rural area, the rural-urban divide, the small population is a factor. Governor from Virginia, Youngkin, just put in $500 million into the state of Virginia to help childcare. We don't have that kind of tax base, right? So some of these things, you can look at other states that are putting hundreds of millions of dollars into the childcare sector, but they have different industries. They don't have the kind of budget that's volatile like ours. There's just a lot of factors that I was having difficulty making that state fit into our state. So I know that the task force has been digging into all that, and we're trying to take pieces that'll work here in Alaska. But I think once it's vetted, we'll see what are those sources that we can, is it the state, is it the feds, what can the private sector do, what can the community do? You know, we have child care providers in churches, you know, small providers in houses. Everybody needs to take a piece to get the solution.
Question. Just looking at the definition of child care, it's the definition was under daycare rights in the current law, and now the title is being changed. Mm-hmm. But just thinking back to the limited amount of exposure I had to this issue, you'd think that child care is just that child care. It's monolithic. It's just across the board, but mm-hmm. it's not. It's you know, prenatal visits, early intervention, every family, every case study is so different. But is this definition of child care, is that all-encompassing that it needs to be now, or is this going to broaden once the task force has finished its work?
So through the chair to Representative Edgman, the change from daycare to child care was really from the child care sector. We found that a lot of child care workers did not feel like they were being respected for what the work they did. The industry as a whole, because of low wages and lack of training, they have, a lack of respect. And so they didn't like the term daycare. I changed it to child care. I assumed that eventually it will probably be early education. But there were a lot of discussions in the task force about what can we do to elevate this profession. Terminology matters. It counts. They're not babysitters. They're teaching children. They're feeding children. They're keeping them safe. So that was the impetus for the change. But early childhood education is probably where it's going to land.
Okay. That was very helpful. Thank you,
Mr. President. Thank you. Let's see, we do have a hard stop. I received a note a little while ago, so we're going to have a hard stop at 3:30 today. And so I just want to throw that out there, but I think we're doing okay. So next up, we have the actual adoption of this new version of the bill. So again, we're not passing out the bill, just need to have it before the body. So with that, the motion was made by Representative Johnson, and I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections to adopting CS for House Bill 89? Seeing none, the version S is our working draft for HB 89. And so I would like to thank all of you. And I think we'll next move to public testimony. We have invited testimony first. Looks like we've got two people, and then I'm counting five, but that might include the two folks or six maybe who would like to do public testimony. So with that, first of all, we will move to Ms. Griffiths, and she is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the Alaska Children's Trust. Ms. Griffiths, are you there?
I am. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us. Can you put yourself on the record, please?
Yes. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of House Finance. My name is Jen Griffith, and I am Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for Alaska Children's Trust. Alaska Children's Trust is testifying today in support of House Bill 89. As the statewide lead organization focused on the prevention of child abuse and neglect, we support policies that increase economic security for families and provide foundational early education support for children. House Bill 89 does both by increasing access to quality, affordable child care for Alaska's families. Currently, the average family in Alaska is paying 15 to 35% of their income for child care, and 51% of families say they can't participate in the workforce to the extent that they would prefer due to child care issues. According to Kids Count 2023, Alaska ranks 44th in the nation for economic well-being, and 34% of Alaska children have parents that lack secure employment. House Bill 89 would increase the eligibility limits for child care assistance, allowing more Alaska families access to affordable child care and providing more parents the opportunity to participate in the workforce. Parents who are able to access the child care they need report reduced stress and increased economic stability, both important societal factors for decreasing the risk of child abuse and neglect. And quality child care allows children to grow and develop to their full potential, increasing their readiness for school and eventually the workforce. While House Bill 89 does not solve all of the challenges currently facing Alaska's child care system, it's an important step towards revitalizing our child care sector in a way that supports our children, families, communities, and businesses. We encourage your support for House Bill 89. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we will go to Dr. Jessica Parker, who has also been invited testimony. So with that, Ms. Dr. Parker, if you could put yourself on the record.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, my name is Dr. Jessica Parker, and I am writing to express my strong support for House Bill 89, which addresses the urgent daycare crisis faced by organizations like ours. I'm the superintendent of Little Mountain Movers Academy and Mountain City Christian Academy. We are Anchorage's largest childcare and private K-12 school. And I've seen firsthand, just like everyone's been talking about the difficulties that our staff and the families that we serve encounter as a result of the current regulations. The increasing demand for daycare services, particularly for infants, has resulted in a massive waiting list, making it very difficult for us to meet our community's increasing needs. The existing regulations create barriers that limit our capacity to efficiently staff and provide appropriate space for the children in our care. Little Mountain Movers is one of Anchorage's remaining three infant care programs, as more and more daycares are forced to close due to strict requirements and less available grant funding opportunities, especially now that COVID is over. We currently have a capacity of 120 children, and we're looking to extend it to 300. We have a wait list of 88 children. Most of those are infants, but because the staffing ratios and square footage regulations for infant care is so high, it's cost adverse for us to open up those infant seats where the demand is greatest. House Bill 89 would bring much-needed relief by making significant changes to the daycare assistance and the child care grant program. This bill would raise the maximum monthly household income allowed for a family to participate to 300% of the state's poverty threshold, and the proposed amendments recognize the actual average cost of providing child care and modifies grants on a geographic basis. This recognizes the diverse needs and economic realities faced by our child care facilities in different regions, particularly in Anchorage, Alaska. I applaud the legislator for recognizing the urgency of this issue and proposing solutions through House Bill 89. Please support and pass this bill and more like it. You are making a positive impact on the accessibility and quality of child care services in our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Parker. I don't see any questions from the committee. I'll move to the third and last invited testifier, and then we will move to public testimony. So with that, we have Stephanie Berglund. If you're there, if you can put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Foster and the committee for hearing House Bill 89 and for your interest and support for child care. My name is Stephanie Berglund. I'm the CEO of THREAD, Alaska's Child Care Resource and Referral Organization. THREAD is a 38-year-old nonprofit providing services statewide to strengthen access to affordable and high-quality early childhood education with focus on child care. We serve more than 10,000 families, 2,000 early educators, and 430 early childhood programs each year. The child care sector is fragile. It's long been a sector with institutional deficiencies for decades, but has seen increased challenges over the last 4 years. Since 2020, we've seen over 25% of the licensed child care programs close across the state. And of those that are open, they're not able to serve all the children they would like due to staff shortages. I want to pause to let that sink in. Alaska has lost one quarter of our child care program and will lose more if we do not see sustainable and meaningful investment for child care from the state. The child care workforce is struggling due to low wages and often few benefits at the same time when there's high competition for qualified workers in Alaska. In the current state, fewer families are able to access affordable and quality child care services than ever before. When we don't have a strong child care sector, we see our economic infrastructure struggle. Businesses are not able to recruit and retain quality employees, and families are not able to participate in the workforce as they want. Our most recent research and data conducted in partnership with the Alaska Chamber and the McKinley Group have shown that businesses are greatly impacted by families struggling with child care, including poor attendance and loss in productivity. To restate what you've already heard, child care challenges for working families result in absences and employee turnover that cost businesses an estimated $152 million annually. When Alaskans can't work, they don't have the financial security to support their families, they aren't able to achieve their self-sufficiency goals, and they aren't able to contribute to the economy. This not only stifles the quality of life for families, this stalls Alaska's growth. HB 89 adds incentives for businesses to support child care and strengthens the child care assistance and subsidy program. While there are many areas of the child care system that need support, HB 89 aims to strengthen child care assistance by allowing more families to participate in the program and creates flexibility in child care resources with aim to support child care programs with the targeted supports they need. Changes in child care assistance are needed. Currently, too few families participate in the program as they don't qualify or can't access resources under the current structure. Families utilizing child care assistance pay a copay for services in addition to the cost differential. For example, if a family household child care expense is $1,200 a month for one child, their child care assistance may support just part of that. Let's say it's $500 a month. The family pays a required copay. Let's say that's $100, and they still are required to pay the difference remaining, which would be $600 a month. For many families, this estimate of an example of $700 a month in their child care expense is still unaffordable, even with the assistance, and therefore makes access to quality child care unattainable for many. Last year, THREAD partnered with McKinley Group to conduct a statewide household survey collecting information directly from families about child care. 585 families with over 1,000 children were surveyed. The largest barrier to child care cited is the lack of providers at 74%. Cost is the next most frequent cited barrier at 60%. The cost is cited as a barrier to finding child care most for families in urban areas at 65% compared to 49% in rural areas. These and other barriers are impacting families' ability to participate in the workforce. Just over half of families, 51%, report that household members' ability to be employed or work more hours was impacted by quality, availability, or cost of child care. This is a large change from the same survey we conducted in 2019, where 22% of families surveyed reported that child care barriers are impacting their ability to be employed or work as much as they would like. This is a 29% increase in families not being able to work due to childcare. These findings underscore the need for childcare change to strengthen our collective workforce and economy. Childcare is expensive. Childcare prices have risen and during the last 3 years have outpaced inflation. Quality childcare is expensive to provide, and for low-income families, expanded support is needed to afford the care and education services they need. The time is now for childcare change. One lever of change, as you've been talking about, is through HB 89 and increasing childcare assistance access. This bill will allow more families to qualify and thus allow more families access to quality childcare. Additionally, childcare businesses are currently reimbursed at childcare assistance program rates set by the market rate survey. That's based on the amount of what providers charge for care, not what it actually costs to provide quality care. When we base childcare policies, including childcare reimbursement rates, on the market rate survey, that does not consider the true cost of care. This creates an unstable foundation for the childcare system. Thread is encouraged to see the current research underway to understand the true cost of care. We look forward to seeing that data and encourage it to be used in conjunction with market rate prices and policy and fiscal planning for childcare support. Considering the true cost of providing childcare in our policies will inform a more stable childcare system. Thread is happy to be endorsing HB 89 as it is a key step toward more affordable access to care for families. Thread encourages legislators to consider this bill, and as you've been discussing, other policies that will also reduce childcare costs for parents and increase supports for childcare providers. We appreciate the sponsor for bringing this bill forward and thank the chair and committee for considering the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and thank you for your time and support of our young children and families in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berglund. I don't see any. We do have a question from Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Just quickly, Ms. Berglund, thank you for your testimony. Does Thread offer its employees a dependent care account through a FSA?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Staff. We do not. We are proud to offer paid family leave for our staff as a benefit.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, Ms. Berglund, I'm curious about whether I see the number $22 million in FY22, and then I think last year the state contribution was $7 or $7.5 million. I assume none of that lapsed, and it all got spent for a good purpose. And I'm just curious if you know in a 12-month fiscal year when the money ran out, if it did run out.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Josephson. And I think the department can give you more accurate figures if you're asking about some of the specific COVID relief. The parts I can respond to are the parts where Thread partnered with the state to deliver support for childcare, and some of the remaining federal COVID relief dollars are in their final year of spending. So those all had to be obligated through the state through the end of the federal fiscal year, which of course was the end of September. So we are in the final stages of planning and executing some final grants to childcare programs. There's an open grant opportunity for childcare programs right now. You can find that on the Thread website called the Focus on Childcare Grant, Building Resilience Post-Pandemic. So this will be the last and final broad-based non-competitive grant for all eligible child care programs to receive federal relief dollars.
Follow-up?
I guess where I'm going through the chair, Ms. Berglund, is this. I like the bill very much. My concern is that the fiscal note says that in February 2023, well, maybe it was just that month, but at any rate, we're going back to the previous normal under, I guess, the governor's concept for the budget, for a state direct subsidy. And then we're adding tax credits. And so it's in sort of the, I'm going to guess, $6, $7 million range per year. And I'm just wondering, what is that? And I know there'll be more people eligible to qualify, but how far can $6 or $7 million take us? That's what I'm wondering.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Josephson. I am not the right person to answer that question, so I would defer you back to specific questions back to the department and the Child Care Program Office to assist.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Berglund. I don't see any further questions. So with that, that is the end of our invited testimony. I will now open up a public testimony on House Bill 89, which is the Daycare Assistance Child Care Grant Program. Just a reminder, if folks would like to submit written testimony, anyone watching, you can submit that to house.finance@akleg.gov. Again, house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, I believe we've got two people online, but before we go to them, is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? And I see none, so we'll go to online here. First, we've got one person in Fairbanks, one in Sitka. First, we've got Brianna Garcia de la Cruz. If you'd like to state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, good afternoon, co-chairs and finance committee members. Thank you for having me. My name is Brianna Garcia Delacruz, and I am a program director of a nonprofit child care center in Fairbanks. Today, I'm testifying on behalf of the Alaska Early Childhood Advocacy Group in support of House Bill 89. The Alaska Early Childhood Advocacy Group is a group of nine nonprofits from across the state that have joined together to advocate for increased investment and improved policies to support Alaska's child care sector. Child care in Alaska continues to struggle. Over 51% of families are not participating in the workforce to the extent that they would like to due to the lack of child care. Their average child care worker makes $29,500 per year, which is less than a gas station attendant. And the average Alaska family pays 15 to 35% of their income for child care. Child care programs across the state continue to close, negatively impacting children, families, communities, businesses, and our economy. While House Bill 89 will not solve all of the challenges facing the child care sector, it is a step in the right direction, increasing the eligibility limit for families accessing child care assistance support, both parents and child care programs. And the business tax credits for child care will encourage businesses to invest in child care options for their employees. The Alaska Early Childhood Advocacy Group urges you to support your support for House Bill 89, as it is an important step towards transforming Alaska's child care sector, supporting children and families, and benefiting our economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see any questions or comments from the committee. So with that, we'll next move to our final testifier. That is Carrie Sagel. If you can state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony. It looks like you're calling in from Sitka.
Hi, my name is Carrie Sagel. I thank you for this opportunity. I am calling on behalf of Sitka's Early Childhood Coalition, a coalition of parents, child care providers, agencies, employers, educators, tribal and city government representatives, addressing the issue of child care in Sitka and Alaska, and calling on behalf of support of House Bill 89 as an initial step in the state of Alaska's efforts to address the issue. We're in favor of any measure that reduces burdens on family and child care providers and increases access to early childhood education. See five reasons. It provides a safe and social learning environment for children and prepares them to be ready for kindergarten and further education. It allows families to make employment choices to benefit their own family as well as the community, reducing stress on families and the community. It creates stability for providers and stability for providers and stability for families, employers, and the community. And it provides equity. The school district recently held focus groups on the topic of bullying, and it relates to this topic in that one of the themes that came out is early childhood inequities just continue to grow
and create gaps, which provide create problems for families. Stage that addressing equity is most important. The free market is not a viable economic system for child care. It is requires municipal, state, federal, and large employer solutions. So we here in SIDCARB very desperately in any efforts in supporting child care. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sagal. Do we have any questions? I see none, so thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room or online who I might have missed who'd like to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And folks can submit written testimony, again, to house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that, I will go ahead and set an amendment deadline for next Thursday, so from a week from today, next Thursday, February 1st at 5 p.m., and if you have any amendments, can you please submit those to my staff, Brody Anderson in the corner back there, or our clerk, Helen Phillips, again by next Thursday. So with that, maybe let's take a quick 3-minute stretch your legs while the next presenter, which is on HB 50, it's the new CS for the carbon storage bill. They'll be presenting that, introducing that. Have no intention to move that, but we want to get that before us. So let them get set up. I don't know if they've got something to put on the screen, but we'll just take a quick 3 minutes. So, at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:55 p.m. And so next up, we have the carbon storage bill. Just one more reminder, we do have a hard stop at 3:30 today. We have a committee substitute for the bill. So with that, I would entertain a motion. Co-Chair Johnson?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move that House Finance Committee would adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 50, Work Draft 33-GH1567-R, dated 1/22/24 as our working document.
Okay, and I will object for the purposes of an explanation and ask the Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner Crother, as well as Deputy Director Payne, ask them if they could please come up and explain the changes. And we also have, it looks like, Commissioner Huber from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission also be testifying. So with that, we have the CS before us and a explanation forthcoming. Please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Chair Foster, members of the committee. For the record, this is John Crother, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. To speak to the committee substitute very briefly, this merely strikes one of the sections of the bill that was adopted by the legislature last session and enacted into law that granted primacy, authority to pursue primacy to our Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So that effort is underway. We have a presentation for you today that updates, and Commissioner Huber is going to provide some updates about how that work is going, in addition to just an overview and recap of the bill. But that the committee substitute basically removes the language from the current work draft, given that it was enacted last year and is already actively underway. So,
great. Thank you. Please proceed.
Chair Foster, would you like us to proceed to the presentation?
Yes.
Okay. So, again, John Crother, a deputy commissioner here. I'll do a quick overview of just the outline of our presentation, some of the key themes we want to share with the committee today, a recap of the legislation. We'll have our Commissioner Huber of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission do an update of how his conversations and work with the Environmental Protection Agency, the US EPA, is going as they begin those primacy negotiations. And then Deputy Director Payne will summarize a little bit about the bill just as a refresher for the committee. And we'll move quite quickly, and unless, of course, there's questions and we can be responsive there. So at a high level, the recap of the legislation, the intent of it is to make our subsurface resources, our extensive geologic reservoirs, pore space underground, available for maximum use. We already do mineral development of those resources, oil and gas development, other kinds of use of those resources, but this is focused on the sequestration of carbon dioxide underground, making maximum use of the state's pore space. And as mentioned, the committee substitute addressed one of the core elements of this legislation that was before the committee previously, and that was the authority for AOGCC to pursue regulatory primacy. But there's two key elements that remain core to the bill. The first is enabling the Department of Natural Resources to make state lands available through a leasing program for these sequestration activities. And the second empowers and provides specific regulatory frameworks for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission as it administers the program, as it seeks to pursue that primacy to execute those functions. So those remain in the version before the committee under the substitute and continue to be key to making this program work in Alaska.
And maybe just like the last presentation, if we could just hold questions till the end, especially with our, we've got about 30 minutes, so I just want to make sure you can get through the presentation. So please proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll try and be quick, but it's sometimes challenging for me. Just a very quick recap on the status of the legislation to date. We had significant hearings in the House Resource Committee, 9 hearings there, a committee substitute that addressed several significant updates, improvements to the bill, supported by the administration and continue to be before the committee in this current substitute you're considering. That included some general policy language that was removed. It modified the status of some funds to ensure they were not sweepable. It adjusted the commercial terms to allow more flexibility, as we see in the developing market for these projects. It importantly removed federal 45Q tax credits from being incorporated by reference in the state corporate tax code, and it also added clear regulatory authority to the Department of Environmental Conservation for transportation of carbon dioxide. And we also have had five hearings before this committee on the legislation and look forward to more. Just very high level for the committee, and we can certainly brief your offices more about these advancements if we see them. But there's been significant movement in the broader CCUS space, the carbon capture utilization storage space, over the last year, both in Alaska, nationally, and internationally. On the national front, we see projects actually starting operations in North Dakota. I believe some members of the committee had the opportunity to travel with the department and with some other Alaska stakeholders to see those firsthand, see them in operation. Very exciting to see that stood up in a sister resource state. Wyoming, another state that's been a leader in carbon capture, has issued its own, under its primacy, has issued its first Class 6 well approval as of last month. And Louisiana has received that primacy from EPA generally as of last month as well. So one of the things that Commissioner Huber will talk about is some of the lessons learned, what we see in that Louisiana approval, and how that affects both our legislation and our program going forward. And then finally, I'd note quickly for the committee, we've also seen federal support for CCUS in Alaska already. Some grants that have been issued, work to characterize the resources in Cook Inlet, work to assess the feasibility of direct air capture projects. And so those are exciting, and we view them as a strong impetus to continue to pursue the legislation and get this framework in place. And I think with that, that concludes my portion of the presentation. I'll turn it over to Chair Huber.
Mr. Huber, if you can put yourself on the record.
And co-chairs. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, and committee members. For the record, my name is Brett Huber, and I serve as the public commissioner and chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I appreciate the chance to be with the House Finance Committee today and provide an update on our efforts regarding seeking primacy for the category of Class 6 wells. Mr. Chairman, I know you're under a press for time. If you'd like me to sum my presentation up, I could say we are advancing and things are going well, but my guess is you're going to want to hear just a little bit more than that. So let's go ahead and go on to the next slide.
By the way, that was a great great summary. But it does help to frame, I think. Looks like there's a lot of detail here, so that was helpful. Thank you.
Number 7. Senate Bill 48 passage last session provided the authority to seek primacy, as you know. It also adopted a fiscal note and appropriation of the budget for two positions, including the carbon engineer and an assistant, as well as funds for contractual and legal support. Thank you for your efforts in moving that portion of the legislation last year and the commensurate funding. Slide number 8, please. Primacy has been and should be expected to continue to be a multi-year process. For states that have completed the process, the time range has been from 3 to 6 years. We're in the pre-application phase now and have been since our initial meeting late last spring. We are aiming for 2 years to complete the process in Alaska. We are hopeful that some experience for the EPA and insight for us with the other states they have approved, North Dakota, Wyoming, and Louisiana, in that order, will allow us to meet that goal. That said, we only have a control over a portion of the process with the EPA, and their interaction and approval are entirely in their court. I apologize, there's a little inaccuracy in this slide. I think that's due to the translation and version issues as our two agencies prepared the deck. While the slide suggests that all of the bullet listed items are cooperative state EP effort, the items that AOGCC and EPA will work on cooperatively are the MOA and the crosswalk. The governor's letter, the AG statement, program description are the state's responsibility. In addition, a complete application must also include a copy of the state statutes and regulations which pertain to CCUS and documentation of our public participation process.
Mr. Huber? Yes. I'm sorry, we're having a hard time hearing you. We're trying to turn up the volume on our side, but maybe can you move a little closer to your mic?
Absolutely. I'm sorry. I'll just hold it right here in my hand. Is that better, Mr. Chairman?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay, let me see where I'm at in our presentation. Only once we've submitted the complete package will we be considered in the application phase with EPA. You'll note components of the program description are included on this slide as well. go on to slide 9, please. Slide 9 is a brief history of the AGCC interactions with EPA pertaining to CCUS. Interaction began with receipt of a letter of inquiry by the EPA seeking states that would have interest in a Class 6 primacy grant program and pursuing Class 6 primacy. This letter was forwarded to me from the governor's office last January. I replied on behalf of the state with our letter of interest on January 31st. Subsequently received notice of grant availability on November 2. We attended the grant webinar on November 16th and completed our grant application in December all of last year. We've been told that $1.93 million is allocated for each applicant state, and grant awards should follow sometime late spring or summer. I note the grant term is 5 years, indicating potentially that a protracted primacy process is still anticipated by the EPA. Next slide. Oh, no, hang on. Our introductory meeting with EPA was with Lauren Boldrick, the EPA Oil and Gas Policy Advisor in Region 10. Our kickoff meeting for our primacy efforts happened following the granting of legislative authority to our agency. This meeting included the Region 10 UIC manager, as well as the DC headquarters program manager, Bill Bates, and three of his staff. At that meeting, we asked them for an initial review of the legislation for any red flags they may see for the primacy process. Their review did highlight several areas of concern, and we're working cooperatively with DNR and the GLO on potential amendments to address them. Next slide, please. Central to the primacy process is the required regulatory crosswalk comparing state statutes and regulations with the federal code. EPA authority for the regulation of CCUS is in the Clean Water Act and Safe Drinking Water Act. The primacy process is meant to ensure that the state is meeting or exceeding standards for the protection of fresh water and drinking water, and that it is demonstrated adequately in regulation. This document is expected to be several hundred pages, as this is a large regulatory lift. That brings us to the areas of concern that the EPA shared with us. The first is the good cause waivers. That language continues in the bill currently. EPA has not granted such waivers and is unlikely to do so in the future. The second area is concerning the post-closure period regarding liability transfer process and the operation and surety of financial assurance tools, like a trust fund as proposed in the legislation. We've been working closely with DNR and reviewing successful applicant states' approaches to recommend a path forward. We like the Louisiana approach as it met EPA scrutiny and provides safeguards to the state for that period following issuance of a closure certificate through the end of the 50-year EPA-required monitoring period. We're continuing to work on a similar approach and language for a potential amendment. We asked for this early review, Mr. Chairman, to try to avoid having to come back to the 34th legislature and ask for amendments necessary to achieve primacy. We appreciate the substantial legislative time and effort that's been allocated to this issue already. That said, the EPA review was noted to be, quote, cursory and preliminary, and other issues could arise that need statutory amendment. I plan to request an additional, more thorough review as these bills continue to advance through the process. Next slide, please. I believe that we're assembling a strong team for this effort and also for the implementation of the program once we attain primacy. Our legal team consists of our dedicated Assistant Attorney General and other DOL support, as well as contracted services with Susan Pollard, no stranger to many of you, as former Department of Law Regulatory Section Chief. We believe that Ms. Pollard's significant experience with Alaska statutes and regulations will be a tremendous benefit to us. Work products for this team include the EPA-required crosswalk and memorandum of agreement, as I spoke of earlier. The commissioners and staff are leading the regulatory package development, outreach, and public participation efforts, as well as providing the technical input to the legal team. We're looking forward to adding two new hires that should round out our team for the primacy effort, as well as help lead us into the actual program implementation. We're currently scheduling interviews for the applicants to the Carbon Reservoir Engineer and are reviewing applications for the recently closed Carbon Assistant position and plan to have those positions filled soon. Final slide, please. This slide provides information on the request for information we conducted this early fall and a planned RFP to come along a little later. We may desire to issue the RFP sooner if we find we need additional expertise during the primacy process. We'll have a better idea of the best and the most cost-effective mix of internal staff and use of consultants going forward when we fill our carbon position. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation and update on our process. I'm happy to take questions from your committee should you wish.
We're going to hold questions till the end, Mr. Huber. So I don't know if you or Ms. Payne has the next section.
Yes. Chair Foster, for the record, my name is Haley Payne. I am the Deputy Director for the Division of Oil and Gas, and I'll be presenting the next couple sections to you. So since the bill was first introduced, there's been a lot of developments nationally in terms of other states licensing their pore space. And so we now have some other analogs in which to examine to compare to our own bill as well. There's a lot of information on this slide, so I won't go over every detail. But some of the big takeaways are that in this investigation, it became clear that there's not really one particular leasing mechanism or one particular public process or even one particular suite of commercial terms that applies throughout. Even within states, we see a lot of variance in terms of how they approach the leasing agreements for each particular operator. Of note, what I'll point out is that we don't see any minimums instituted in statute for any of these states, which is similar to the committee substitute that you see here in the bill. At this time, it's only the Texas General Land Office that does put forward any minimums, but those are not in statute. Those are a part of their request for proposals or their lease sale process. Another difference about the mechanism of Texas versus Wyoming or Louisiana is that when Texas passed its legislation back in 2009, they commenced their general land office to do a study for site characterization for CO2. And it's only on those tracts that were fully characterized that they're offering for sale. That site characterization study took 5 years from the time the legislation was passed. DNR's model may look more similar to the Wyoming State Land Office or the Louisiana Office of Mineral Resources. With that, I'll move to the next slide, which is slide 15. So this will take us just back to the bill itself that's before you. And so advancing one more slide, which is slide 16. The purpose of this slide is just to bring forward the different phases of a CCUS project and demonstrate how the bill before the committee actually touches on all of these different phases. We cover everything from the exploration and delineation phase, through the well and facility permitting, the actual leasing of the pore space, conductions of storage operations, the facility closure, and even the post-closure beyond when all the regulatory requirements have been met. In particular, Section 16, which impacts the Department of Natural Resources, and Section 33, which is the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, are where you're going to find the majority of the components of the bill that I'll highlight on the next slide.
And Chair Foster and members of the committee, John Crowther, for the record here, I just note the section references in this slide are to the current U version. This, when the committee substitute was put out, it updates the sections to reflect updated numbers for the deletion, which are not yet reflected on our slide, but future presentations, of course, will make that update if the committee adopts that substitute.
Great. Thank you.
So this slide points to the four major authorizations, which are envisioned under HB 50, and shows those broken out into the two different regulatory bodies. So the Department of Natural Resources will be licensing the state's pore space. It starts with the issuance of a carbon storage exploration license. This is going to allow an operator to delineate the subsurface and understand what may be used as a suitable reservoir for injection purposes. Once they have that information together, they will then apply to the AOGCC for the carbon storage facility permit. And this is going to be really the rigorous evaluation of that subsurface container, ensure the protection of other mineral interest owners, and provide for the amalgamation of the pore space based on that geologic and engineering data. Once a licensee can demonstrate to DNR that they have that permit from AOGCC, we will then institute them a carbon and storage lease. And this is the lease that will actually authorize the injection of the CO2 into the pore space and will be the governing contract for the duration of the operations and into the post-closure period. Finally, the last major mechanism in the bill is the closure certificate. And this is one that AOGCC will be issuing and was alluded to by Commissioner Huber. This is what is enabled for once an operator has cessationed of injection operations and has been able to demonstrate that the plume is stabilized and met all regulatory requirements, they would then move forward with a closure certificate for the actual operations. And as written in the bill now, this period would be funded by a carbon storage trust fund over the life of the project.
If we could hold our questions. Thank you.
So this will be the last slide here, slide 18. And so this is just another way of looking at those same authorizations, but more over a timeline. Again, showing on the top, you've got the DNR carbon storage lease, which enables the exploration, feasibility, and project design aspects that then transitions into a carbon storage lease once the AOGCC permit has been issued. Also important to note here is this is an estimated timeline, and this is a timeline that's based on projects in North Dakota. North Dakota has some different options than we have for some of our operations, so it doesn't account for some of our seasonality. So even on an aggressive timeline, these can still take as long as 3 to 4 years, and so we may anticipate that taking even longer here in Alaska. It also indicates the outlay of the number of capital expenditures right up front, the shooting of seismic, the drilling of stratigraphic test wells, a lot of the front-end engineering and design. So even prior to operations or any ability to realize the benefit of these facilities, these companies are outlaying hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's sort of similar to what we see in our oil and gas operations as well. So with that, I believe we have made it to the questions portion and try to get through those as quickly as possible for you.
Great. Thank you very much. So just to kind of sum up here, the CS here, the major change is the deletion of Section 3, and then this is a nice update in terms of, I guess, what's going on here. And thank you very much for that. It's very descriptive. So with that, we have questions from Representative Josephson, then Representative Galvin, Representative Hannon, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, one thing, let me ask one thing from the outset. I think the bill refers to our taking ownership of the asset after 10 years. But we've heard from the federal government that that's inadequate. They want the industry, I guess, to control that for 50 years. How is it that we got to the number 10 and they got to the number 50? Can you explain that discrepancy?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I'll try and briefly answer that. John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here, and then Director Payne, or Deputy Director Payne, may have some more clarity. Our intent with the bill as drafted was to create a situation that was induced development, promoted development, by giving a time frame kind of within a corporate planning horizon where the company could plan for that 10-year obligation, and then through the funding of the trust fund and other steps, the state as landowner and as sovereign would assume that responsibility. So we viewed that as a time frame within which a corporate entity could plan for a project and that would induce and support development. Other states have been looking at similar kind of frameworks. The restrictions from the EPA requiring that operator maintain for the full 50-year period in some ways makes perhaps these projects more challenging, but also increases the operator direct responsibility. And so, that's one of the areas we're looking at potential amendments to make sure our framework is consistent with EPA mandates there, and I hope that answers your question.
And for the record, this is Haley Payne again. So I would just add that the legislation as drafted was based upon the model that was developed by the Interstate Oil and Gas Conservation Commission as the recommended best practices, and that also served as the basis for North Dakota for their legislation. And also to note, the 10-year period is not just at the 10-year as a demarcation, but also would have to demonstrate the stabilization of the plume. And it was the understanding of multiple folks that the CO2 plume would actually be stabilized within that 10-year period. But we, of course, are eager to continue to work to make sure that this is in line with the EPA and what will be best to ensure the AOGCC can do the primacy process.
Follow up?
That answer was comprehensive for sure. The one thing that's been raised, and I'm trying to do my due diligence, and I started to look at some natural resources hearings. That testimony was a little bit more scientific in nature, which makes sense, given the difference in committee. The geologist at one, the state's geologist at one hearing talked about how CO2 could be used to boost or enhance oil recovery. And it got me thinking about, with my staff's assistance, ABLE assistance, there is a section of the bill, now I'm looking at version R, admittedly, but on enhanced oil or gas recovery. Here's the essence of my concern. I don't want credits to be double-dipping where it has application for regular oil development, but also has application for CCUS. Is the language clear enough in the bill so that whatever the activity is, the capital activity, we know that they're supposed to go down track one and not track two, and not go down both for purposes of deductions?
Yeah, Representative Josephson through the chair, John Crowther here. I think we believe the bill does set appropriate clarity for when and how CCUS licenses are integrated with existing oil and gas leases and operations. I would note for your reference, if I understand your question correctly, the one of the categories is created by the underlying federal tax credit as opposed to by the state framework. And so an operator has the, if they magically have a source of CO2, there's the potential to sequester it in a pure sequestration effort and get a certain level of a 45Q federal tax credit. There's also the ability to sequester it in certain manners associated with EOR if it meets the criteria set out in that in the federal program and get a subordinate lesser tax credit for those operations. There's also other kinds of EOR, other pressure management activities that may not qualify for the tax credit, but an operator may choose to do anyway. So all three of those categories are a potential use of CO2, so to speak. And we think that both our legislation and the federal, our legislation sets the right framework amongst those. There are some questions as we work through implementation of the federal, that all parties, operators, state sovereigns, are looking for federal guidance and clarity on. But I think we view we're setting the right framework that doesn't create any ambiguity there.
Mr. Chair, I think that I, at least, I can't speak for the other 10 of you, it might be good to almost have an illustration of this so that there is, for example, in Category 1, a description of an activity that that relates more to regular oil recovery, even if it has some functionality for purposes of carbon storage. I'm sure that that Mr. Crowther's response makes sense. I think I may need to hear it again. And, you know, we know, for example, under our net system that production at Willow and Pekka will impact, we heard yesterday, our revenue. And I just want to make sure that we're not stepping into an area that we're going to regret, not overly concerned, just want to clarify, relative to giving credits that have a dual purpose. That's all. And I'm sure it's my ignorance more than anything else. That's all I have for today.
Thank you. And indeed, this is a new and fairly complex bill. And it looks like that was being written down, and I think that'll be forthcoming. And this is certainly, we probably have a few more hearings on this before we decide what we're going to do. So I do want to make sure that folks are comfortable with, however we decide to move forward. And with that, we're getting close to our ending time, so we're going to take the questions I've got on the list here from Representative Galvin, Hannon, and Stapp. And then if there's a desire, we can move or accept the committee substitutes. And as I mentioned, we'll have more meetings on this. So with that, the next step, we've got Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. And this is following up on some of the line of questioning that we heard from Representative Josephson. And it is related to the slide page 16, again, the long-term monitoring. And I think what I heard from you, and I want to just make sure it's clear, that you moved it from the 50-year window to the 10-year window to help with companies who are needing to make plans in a scope that fits a business model. With that in mind, I guess I wondered if there were any other considerations there, thinking about why EPA would have it in at 50 years. I also am just wondering about the costs of DNR, you know, overseeing this as a caretaker function. I don't know if that, what does that mean? Do we have to have some sort of insurance in case something pops up? This is so new to me that I just don't know what liabilities there would be. So thought I would ask those two questions, and that's it. Thank you so much.
Yes, through the chair, this is Haley Payne. I'll try to give very short answers to what could be a really detailed discussion. So maybe just to start with the funding piece, the second mm-hmm. part of your question mm-hmm. there. It is envisioned and is kind of written in the bill itself that over the lifetime of the project, there would be like a per ton injection charge mm-hmm. that would go into a fund, and those would be the funds that would be expended and available for that sort of post-closure period. Mm-hmm. These funds are in addition to all the different levels of bonding that would be required under the Class 6 permit. So this is additional funds beyond those that are already regulatorily required. In terms of where this kind of came from originally, I think even with the EPA having their 50-year minimum, they say 50 years, but it also says or until the applicant is able to demonstrate the stabilization of the plume. So we do share that language with them. And there is one facet that could be, you know, a sort of corporate facet in terms of imagining entities that continue to exist, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years, you know, past the end of their actual project lifetime, which is in some ways, you know, why these funds are imagined as another sort of insurance that there could be. But I think there's also importantly the scientific and like the geologic sort of component to this. Is that it wouldn't just be done in some manner that would allow an entity to sort of walk. It would have to be demonstrated and proven that the subsurface itself has reached a point where there is nothing that's continuing to travel and that area review is stabilized. So it's a mm-hmm. twofold thing between trying to be nimble to the geology as well as recognizing sort of some corporate limitations.
And can you follow up, if I may?
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned the fund, and I wondered, I wonder if there's any modeling of what that might look like, how much. I think originally when we were first brought into a conference room, we were told about sequestration being the great big revenue moment for us. And of course, this is above ground and below ground, so I'm always curious to know if we have done any modeling of what that might look like as this becomes, you know, the way of how we're going to need to do business to help maintain a high level of activity in oil and gas.
Sure. And just briefly, I mean, I think that fund, as we've seen in other states during the Class 6 promise, or excuse me, the Class 6 process, is set on a project-by-project basis. Mm-hmm. And so that depends on the size of the facility, the amount of CO2 being injected. We personally have not done any modeling ourselves, as we don't have any site-specific plans to evaluate. But we do have examples that we can show in North Dakota, where they have the specific financial responsibility amounts modeled out that each entity is required to provide. And then we also see in Louisiana where they have certain minimums and caps in terms of what those actual dollar figures are. So it's more formulaic. Mm-hmm. And again, we're looking closely at Louisiana as that's a state who recently received primacy.
Thank you.
Mr. Crowther
and members of the committee, I just note for clarity, the current committee substitute, it continues to have that 10-year period and the, mm-hmm. the fund language in it. For clarity, we intend to bring forward amendments potentially to adjust that in response to this feedback the EPA has provided. We have not, that's not in the committee substitute, and we don't have language today that would do that.
Thank you.
We are out of time. I wonder if either of the last two folks who have questions would either like to either put the question on the record and then have folks submit a written reply, or if you just would like to hold off and wait till our next hearing. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Both of my questions are homework assignments, so if I could give them to them or ask.
Absolutely. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. The outline for the presentation today spoke to an appendix with a sectional analysis, but it's not here, so if we could get that. And then secondly, the comments about the plume stability remind me that kind of never got back to it at one of the early hearings. Seismic activity, so you know, North Dakota, Louisiana, very different seismic situation than us, and in particular I'm concerned about Cook Inlet Basin sequestration, that how our seismic interactions with that, I assume it affects plume stability and that we'll need to remeasure on a regular basis, and we haven't delved into that in a while. So I'm looking for some of that seismic information with how it interacts with the plume stability longitudinally. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Stapp will ask his question at our next hearing. So with that, we did have a motion to adopt the CS from Representative Johnson, and that is for version R. I objected for purposes of an explanation. I will remove my objection. Are there any objections to adopting the CS as our working draft so that we have that to work? And again, that's just removing Section 3. So seeing none, hearing no objection, our version R has been adopted as our working draft for HB 50. So again, we'll come back to this. Do we have any questions before we adjourn? I see none. So with that, I will announce our next meeting is tomorrow, Friday, January 26th at 1:30 p.m., and we will hear from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. So if there is no other business to come before us, we will be adjourned at 3:31. Thank you.
Your line is muted.